Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And you know, Chinese food is one of the most popular foods, at least restaurant foods, in America, and has been for quite some time. In fact, if I say Chinese, probably one of the first thoughts that come to your head is food. And yet there have been a lot of trials and tribulations with, as any immigrant group, but particularly with the Chinese immigrants, starting with the very first time that they came to America. And a lot of this then had to do with the food, how it was perceived, and how it evolved as well. And here to talk with us about that is Anne Mendelson with her new book, Chow Chop Suey. Anne is a culinary historian and a freelance writer. She wrote for Gourmet for a long time. And she has worked as an editor and collaborator on several cookbooks and wrote the book on milk, on the production and consumption of milk, and a wonderful book on the backstory of the joy of cooking called Stand Facing the Stove. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome Anne and a friend, I must say, here today. Welcome, Anne.
Delighted to be here.
All right. Let's start with the title of the book, The Chow Chop Suey, Food in and the Chinese-American Journey. I mean, that's saying a whole lot right there. But let's start with just the beginning of the title, Chow Chop Suey. What is that?
Well, I have to say at the outset that a lot of my book is about the problems of language. Chinese people and English-speaking people had innumerable impasses of understanding, and this is one of them. Many of you know the phrase chop suey, but I don't think everybody understands that it originated as a more complicated phrase. And there was such difficulty, English speakers and Chinese speakers, making sense of each of what the other was saying, that it entered our language only in a garbled way. Chop suey, chop suey in Cantonese, means odds and ends, or jumbled fragments. And chow stands for the stir-fry method. Chow chop suey means stir-fried odds and ends. Mm-hmm. But when white people started going to Chinese restaurants without the foggiest idea of what they were eating, because nobody could explain it in English and they couldn't read Chinese menus, they latched onto a confused idea that there was this dish called chop suey that came in different forms. You could have chicken chop suey or shrimp chop suey. What they didn't know was that there was a first word that summed up the whole stir-fry experience, chow chop suey, stir-fried odds and ends. Now, when Chinese people put together menus, and when some of them put together English language cookbooks, they wrote not chicken chop suey or shrimp chop suey, but chow shrimp, chow chicken, stir fried. And this escaped the understanding of English speakers, absolutely. They latched onto the idea that there was this dish called chop suey, which there never really was, but Chinese being very happy to accommodate patrons, they went along with the mistake, and the mistake has never been entirely cleared up.
And then, in fact, the word chow, look what happened
yes,
to that, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that has become synonymous with food.
Yes.
Or, you know, hey, let's chow. It's time to chow. Mm-hmm. You know,
and here
it's
time to eat. There's a whole other English speaker's invention.
Well, indeed, and I'm glad that you mentioned that so much of your book is about the language or the difficulties of language, because that was evident in reading through and reading through some of the reviews and just background of Chinese language and the difficulties for the Chinese in Chinese language. How many, I think one of the reasons many came over here were illiterate, so to speak. I mean, not reading in general terms all languages, but just a small, of their language, a small faction of the Chinese symbols. Bring us up to date with the history of Chinese immigration to the U.S. and some of the difficulties that occurred.
Well, some listeners may know that there were terrible wars and other disasters in South China in the 19th century. There were famines, there were floods, there were massacres, and Guangdong province in southern China was a good place to get out of if you could. The Opium Wars that were conducted by Great Britain during the 1930s and 40s made things worse. And one of the few good things about the Opium Wars was that they established Hong Kong as a British possession, taking over a tremendous amount of commerce between South China and everywhere else in the world, including a new state called California in the U.S. So a pipeline of people materialized, leaving from Hong Kong and going to Gold Rush, California, where the Chinese were at first welcomed very happily, because they were excellent organizers. Among other things, they organized supplies of Chinese food to be sent from Hong Kong to San Francisco. And various restaurants started up in San Francisco that were very popular with newcomers, both Chinese and otherwise. People from all over the world, and people from all over the eastern United States. The crunch came a few years later when members of the new American labor movement started to notice that Chinese would work endless hours at all kinds of difficult jobs for much less pay than white people. If this sounds familiar,
right?
Does this sound familiar?
Yeah, funny that you should bring it up at this point in time.
And in a very few years. I mean, the honeymoon was maybe from 1849 for 2 or 3 years. Then, out of nowhere, you started seeing these mutterings, these complaints about the horrible, barbaric, nasty Chinese, this race of little verminous people taking honest white men's jobs. And this escalated into the worst persecution that's ever been visited on any race in this country, except for African Americans and Native Americans. By the 1870s and 80s, there were lynchings going on in the Far West, wherever there were Chinese trying to compete for jobs. And there was arson. There were calls for Congress to do something about these horrible, nasty interlopers. And Congress obliged by passing the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. This is the only piece of legislation ever enacted by Congress to keep out immigrants from one country, one foreign country.
Again, the corollaries are just too stark. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes. So,
yes.
And this was, so this really, they could come in and work, but in no way could they apply for citizenship or become resident, legal residents, right?
You could become a legal resident under some conditions. The law was chiefly aimed at laborers, manual laborers. You couldn't compete for manual labor jobs with the honest American white working man.
Hmm.
If you were found doing so, you stood to be deported after a year's hard labor. The law kept being renewed, the Chinese Exclusion Act, at something like 10-year intervals. And every time it seemed to make life harder for the Chinese. But if you were not a laborer, if you qualified for businessman or merchant status, then you could become a legal resident. You could not apply for citizenship because since George Washington's first term, applying for citizenship was limited to free white men.
Hmm. So all of this that you prefaced, and or actually not prefaced so much as explained, kind of busts the myth of the Chinese coming over to work on the railroads or the Chinese coming for the gold rush and creating the slop, the chop suey for all the other workers, right? This is something that I think is... If anything else you want to drive home, you want people to understand this, right?
No, the Chinese cooked for themselves very skillfully, with great expertise. And they had the ingredients to work with because they were being exported from Hong Kong. I mean, maybe if you were in the very farthest boondocks, you might have trouble getting stuff. But the Chinese brought their own cooking vessels. They were improvisers. They were just great at figuring out how to meet adversity and how to invent what needed to be invented under difficult circumstances.
Well, you talk a lot about a particular phrase that's used in the Chinese language. Mm-hmm. that describes that. Can you tell us about that?
Xiang Banfa, which I am wildly mispronouncing. I apologize to anybody who speaks Mandarin. It means
Chao Banfa.
Xiang Banfa. It means to come up with a solution for a difficulty. And these people from Guangdong province were masters of the art of doing whatever had to be done. If you had to learn something, you learned it. If you had to do something, you did it somehow or ever or other. It was a powerful survival instinct that stood them in very good stead.
Yeah, indeed. As I was reading some of your the stories that illustrated the Fraser, I was thinking about it. I said, "Wow, what would I think of that? I would say it's akin to deal with it. You know,
yeah.
Just deal with it, right? Take care of it, right?" And yeah, as you say, this did put them in good stead for being in this country where communication was not an easy thing.
Communication was terribly difficult.
Well, aside from the language, I mean, there were particular culinary language barriers as well. But what other features of the Chinese cuisine made it so difficult for Americans that they preferred eating a dumbed down version, or that's all they knew really was a dumbed down version?
It was impossible to explain the concepts, the basic culinary concepts, from the one language to the other. For example, stir-frying, chow, that was the first word in this phrase, chow, chop suey. In the book, I say, how would you explain baking a cake to somebody who'd never seen an oven or cake pans or flour? How would you get the concept across? Well, stir-frying cannot be explained unless you have a wok.
And you know what a wok is,
you have
right?
to know what a wok is.
Right.
Other pans will not produce the same result. You have to have it over a fire that flares up tremendously hot very quickly so that you can cook in just a matter of a few minutes. To do that, you need to cut things into the right-sized pieces. There are names, there's a whole vocabulary for how to cut ingredients before you get anywhere near the stove or the wok. Chinese people knew this from infancy. And by the way, I should add that these were Chinese men who were these very skilled cooks. They didn't bring women. Comparative handful of Chinese women got here as prostitutes, or maybe just a few under better circumstances. But in southern Guangdong province, the family idea was for the wife to marry into the husband's family, come to live in his family home, in the home village, and stay there in seclusion. Women did not participate in daily interchanges with male society, and they did not come to this country except in tiny numbers. The truth is that Chinese men have always been extremely skillful cooks. Mm-hmm. They were not deprived of cooking skills because their women were not with them. Quite the reverse.
Yeah, but even if the women were there, the men would be doing the cooking. Right? Interesting, and it brings up another point I wanted you to talk about, and that is that. There is this misconception that the Chinese laborers came and they were the men and they were cooking and trying to adapt to the Western palate. And yet this didn't happen on the spot when they were coming to America and doing the manual labor as you described. That you just described, Hong Kong was now a British territory. Mm-hmm. There were all the diplomats living there employing men chefs, right?
So Yes. And also, even before Hong Kong became a British territory, when Westerners first started showing up in southern China, 17th, 18th century.
Trading, when
tea and porcelain and silk were being exported for the first time to Europe. The Westerners were not allowed to move around freely, freely, pardon my sore throat.
That's right.
They were pretty much confined to certain areas of Guangzhou City. And They brought some of their own cooks with them, but the Cantonese also seized the opportunity to do cooking for Englishmen and other Westerners, and they promptly learned how to reproduce English food as well as English cooks. Mm-hmm. Westerners were just amazed at this skill, this quickness in grasping anything that you had to learn.
And they did it. That phrase again, Xing Ban Fa. But the chop suey and the intrigue with these dishes that would be prepared and put in front of Westerners took off with such a popularity that suddenly, well, after Chinatowns were formed in many of the cities, that they took off like wildfire. And we're going to talk about those and then the eventual evolution of Chinese food when we come back after a brief break. So stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Well, we are laughing here in the studio. Or eat chop suey. Cheese curds or chop suey. No, we want you to patronize our sponsors for sure. But I'm talking with Ann Mendelson about the Chinese America, the journey of food for the Chinese in America. And so we were talking about the popularity of Chinese food or in chop suey joints in particular. But prior to that, or around the same, there was the growth of Chinatowns, of enclaves of Chinese people. Could you talk about that a little?
Yes. The first Chinatown in the U.S. was in San Francisco. First it was Little China, and then it grew, and after a few years it was called Chinatown. And Chinese people, as the persecution grew, as California and the rest of the western states became more dangerous for them to be in without endangering life and limb, they started moving east, hoping for a less homicidal reception. They got to the Midwest, they got to the East Coast, and they settled in little enclaves where they could avoid the attention of the immigration authorities by setting themselves up as businessmen, people conducting little businesses, not the manual laborers who were not just eligible, they were sure to be deported if they were caught by the immigration folks. So the first stratagem they hit upon was to found small laundries. And as the laundry business changed and more steam-powered machinery started displacing the hand skills, they turned to restaurants. People started founding small restaurants, which qualified them as businessmen or merchants who were safe from being deported. They also, very quickly, we've gotten now to about the 1890s, they realized from their prior experience, noticing what white Americans liked, what the state of American taste was, they realized that they could appeal to the American palate with a mixture of Chinese elements, mostly the stir-fry method, and American-oriented, you should pardon the expression, yeah. American-geared seasonings. Lots of sugar, lots of soy sauce, lots of thick, glossy, starch-thickened sauces. These corresponded to some developments in American taste, the American palate that we see in other contexts. People started, for example, loving baked ham with a lot of sugar and maybe canned pineapple. People started loving Boston baked beans sweetened to the nines. And the Chinese restaurateurs, catering to an American clientele, they very adroitly invented a hybrid version of Chinese food that pushed all the right buttons for white Americans and black Americans, too, who very quickly came to love the so-called chop suey cuisine.
And just what comes into my head, you know, like the very overly sweet and sticky sweet and sour sauces, or the lemon chicken that's, yes, fragrant with lemon, but mostly it's sticky with sugar. And yeah, but these were such new flavor mm-hmm. treats for Americans and Westerners in general. Mostly Americans, because other Westerners in other countries, so I was thinking Europe. I think we're sampling, I hate to use that word authentic, but sampling, you know, maybe cuisine that wasn't quite as adapted, but
I don't know. I think that there was not as much emigration from China to Europe until considerably later. A great deal came to the Americas, Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and Latin America. There was a tremendous influx of Chinese from Guangdong province.
Well, when and why do you think the interest in Chinese food and cooking occurred that brought us, that sort of had many of us leave those, I want to say, it's like Italo-American cuisine, it's Chinese-American cuisine. I think many immigrant groups have those cuisines that are, they are a cuisine in themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, who doesn't still love, you know, some of those old style in Chinese-American foods? But yet we ventured forth to learn a little bit more about Chinese cooking. What, when and why?
I think you have to look at World War II. You have to look, always when you talk about Chinese food in America, there's a geopolitical context, things that were going on in China, things that were going on in the rest of the world. So comes Pearl Harbor, comes World War II. And suddenly, China is our great ally. Chiang Kai-shek commanded the Nationalist Army in China. And in Washington, D.C., representatives of Chiang's government started showing up. Diplomats, military attachés, VIPs with their household retinues, including cooks. These guys were not Cantonese speakers. They didn't come from the sort of peasant background of the Chinese who first came to America during and after the gold rush. This was a new crew of people. They spoke Mandarin. More of them were from the north. They felt that they belonged to sort of a higher echelon of Chinese society than these Cantonese who had preceded them. They let Americans know that Cantonese food was not really as elegant as the food of the northern regions that they came from. And many of these household chefs, they decamped to restaurant jobs after World War II. They founded their own restaurants, starting in Washington, D.C. And during the Cold War, in New York City, which was the headquarters of the new United Nations, they were much resented by the Cantonese speakers, who knew that they had not been welcomed as VIPs. They had been
shunned, actually.
Yeah, they had been shunned, or they had at least been looked down on, chink, chink, Chinaman. And all of a sudden, here are these elegant people who have social confidence as the equals of the cream of American society. Some of the VIPs' wives started founding cooking schools. By now, we're in about the 1950s and 60s. And there was a period when so-called Mandarin cuisine or Northern cuisine or some new style Chinese cuisine, formerly unknown to white Americans, became all the rage among foodies, with a big boost from restaurant reviewers. Restaurant reviewing was then a pretty new profession.
That's right. It was, and Craig Claiborne was, of course, was a champion of mm-hmm. so many of these international cuisines, and especially Chinese.
Yes.
Yeah. So cookbooks, well, cooking classes, as you mentioned, became popular, and cookbooks, and some. Well, there was one prior to that. There was an early cookbook. We skipped over. You said you brought us all the way to the 60s, but I was just, you know, loving the story of Pearl S. Buck. I think we would be remiss if you didn't share that story and the fabulous book that was a result. Two fabulous books.
Well,
Pearl, The Good Earth being the first. Okay, we'll dispense with that. Okay.
Pearl Buck, whom most of us know as the author of The Good Earth and other novels, was married to a very important New York publisher. And she and he together discovered, they suddenly fell upon a treasure. A linguist, Yuan Ren Chao, wrote to inquire, they wrote to him about a potential dictionary to do for their company. And he wrote back, well, no, but my wife has this cookbook. The cookbook became How to Cook and Eat in Chinese, which was published in 1945. And it was an incredible breakthrough in international understanding. It was the first Chinese cookbook in English that had been produced by people who took into account the difficulties of explaining Chinese culinary concepts in the English language.
Which we talked about early in the show, right? And that was important.
So the author, Bui Yang Zhao, was married to one of the greatest linguists of the 20th century, Yuan Ren Chao. Their daughter, their oldest daughter, Rulan, was herself a very notable teacher of Chinese to English speakers. Between the three of them, Bu Wei wrote the cookbook in Chinese. Roland translated it together with many arguments between mother and daughter into English. And then Yuan Renchao went through and fine-tuned things and made changes that he thought were more, I don't like to use the word atmospheric, but conveyed the flavor of the Chinese language better.
So this really was the first book that conveyed classic Chinese cooking.
Well, it conveyed regional Chinese.
Well, and to mm-hmm. a Western audience.
To a Western audience.
Right.
The Chows were not from Guangdong. They were from a region called Jiangnan, which is, well, I think the easiest way to say it, it's close to Shanghai on the Chinese east coast. And this is a great center of Chinese culinary art from way back when. Quite a different school from Cantonese cooking. Although Cantonese cooking is much admired by all Chinese, including the Chows, and they included some Cantonese dishes. They included some from Sichuan and Hunan, some from Beijing, but mostly it was the sort of Shanghai bailiwick.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because you... you know, why Pearl S. Buck? Of course, many of us remember the fact that she spent a lot of her life in China, but she grew up with missionary parents. What I wasn't aware of, though, that was that she was more comfortable in the Chinese language initially with her thoughts, even in writing, than prior to, you know, before English, before the English language. So I could see her excitement in finding a book like this and promoting it.
Yes, the manuscript came in, and Pearl Buck, who had grown up as a little girl speaking the local language of Jiangnan region at least as readily as English, if not more, she always said that she thought in Chinese and mentally translated her own work into English.
Interesting.
She saw this manuscript, and she instantly, by the way, the company had previously turned down several Chinese cookbooks. She had a very low opinion of English language Chinese cookbooks. She took one look and ran into the kitchen and started cooking.
Well, I guess that's a good sign right there. But then, so then we do fast forward to as you said, a transitional period, which would have been the 60s, coming into that. And I don't know if many people listening remember or remember on their parents' shelves a series. Well, there are still some of them in circulation, the Time Life series. And Time Life did this, I have to say, fabulous series, because a lot of people involved in that series were estimable writers and researchers in their own Foods of the World. And the series, I don't know how long it was in the works before it, I think the first was published around 1966 or 68.
Yeah, 67 or 68.
And the Chinese one was wildly popular. But tell me about some of the really thrust things into the crazy market with wanting to become more authentic in our attempts at Chinese cooking.
Well, the cooking schools had quite an influence by this time. There were two teachers who were sort of the leading instructors, Grace Zia-Chu and Florence Lin.
Florence Lin, yeah.
Yes, and they had... students just flocked to their classes in droves. The Chinese cooking rage took hold in the late 50s, early 60s, early 70s. And they were two of the people who were asked to basically put together the food for the Time Life Foods of the World volume in China. There was another angle to the excellence of that book, which was that the photographic staffs of Time and Life got in on the act. And the producers of the series were very conscientious about including photographic instruction, which was something new. It was too, photography was too expensive for ordinary garden variety books. But with all the resources of the Time Life organization behind them.
That's what they were known for anyway, with photographs.
With photographers at hand, they pioneered the business of step-by-step photographic instruction. And there are so many barriers to explaining Chinese cooking in words. You can't, even the Chow family had only managed to get so far in conveying all the things that are so difficult to convey to foreigners about Chinese cooking. But the photography in the Time Life Foods of the World volume went a tremendous way to, to cutting through some Gordian knots, to conveying complicated processes without having to rely on cumbersome language.
And without even, doing the recipe yourself. I mean, it opened the world and opened our eyes to, to these fabulous dishes laid out, in beautiful color in the book. And I think that probably whetted a lot of people's appetite,
indeed,
quite literally, for, to try some of these more authentic, if you will. I hate that word, authentic, but authentic dishes or dishes of actual classic Chinese cuisine.
Yes.
And from there it went, right?
From there it went.
Yeah, from restaurants and cookbooks, I don't think we've stopped.
Never.
Yeah. Given Calvin Trillin's departure there in his poet, I don't know he had that poem in New Yorker. Was it last year or 2 years ago? Time flies. But yes, there's another province, so we'll have more and different Chinese food. But it's a wonderful world of Chinese food. Hey, there's a title for our new book. And, there are no recipes in Anne's. Are there? Did I
miss?
No, there are no recipes in this book, which I found an actual treat because I didn't have to stop and then have to, cook it and digest that. But the information is, you make it so readable and so interesting. It is a history of food, but it's a history of a people. And food is all about the people, right? Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for sharing your time. And I encourage you to, if you're interested at all in Chinese food, you don't need a recipe. Just read this book and your mouth will be watering. It's Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese American Journey by my guest, Anne Mendelsohn. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda.
And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money.
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos.
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.